Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. On today's show, we have a terrific guest that I wanted to have this on the show for quite some time, and of course, he's here now in the moment that a lot of the chickens, you know, are kind of trotting around and coming home to roost, that he has written about for many years. Our guest today is the author and journalist Thomas Frank. He writes regularly for The Guardian, and he is the author of a number of very well-regarded books, including Listen Liberal, which we'll be discussing today, along with Pity the Billionaire, The Wrecking Crew, and What's the Matter with Kansas. His current book is ominously titled, although not inaccurately, Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society. I consider Thomas Frank to be in the absolute first ranks of our not only journalists and authors, but social critics and prescient commentators. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Thomas Frank. Great to have you with us.
Hey, Allison. It's great to be here, and that is very kind of you.
Well, it's really the truth. And yet, you know, I think your insights, warnings, and, you know, have really been far ahead of the curve and have really created a context for many of us to understand what's going on, and yet many more remain in ignorance. You know, can you, before we dip into the current book, can you kind of orient our listeners to Listen Liberal a bit? Because I think that's where a lot of people, after that book was published, everybody was that I know who's progressively oriented was avidly reading you and recommending that everybody else did. And then there's a whole other pocket of people that this book is about who probably don't even know that this is out there in the public consciousness, and we're not paying attention. And I think that is certain kinds of well-intentioned liberals that you characterize in the book. Can you kind of orient our listeners a bit?
Sure. So, Allison, you know, I've been writing since the 80s, and I've had one sort of big subject in my entire life, which is, you know, this great U-turn that this country has been on, you know, the big change that we have been undertaking since the Reagan days, and before that even. I mean, it really began in the 70s. But I've always wanted to understand why we're doing that, the effects that it's having. You know, this is the sort of the enshrinement of free market principles, the rise of the political right, the sort of constant pushing of the politics further and further and further to the right. And all of my books have been about that in some way, about how that is possible. You know, this is a democracy. After all, we basically chose that course. You know, how did we choose a course that's been so destructive for so many people? And you probably remember What's the Matter with Kansas, which was about sort of right-wing populism. God, you know, and now look where we are, right? I wrote that. That came out in 2004. And you know, it's just gotten worse since then. But after I wrote that, I you know, the study of right wing politics, I thought about, you know, it's not possible for right wing politics. They don't operate in a vacuum. You know, it's a two party system that we have in this country, whether we like it or not. And one party has been very good at dragging everything to the right, but what about, you know, what about the other? How have they failed to, you know, to rise to the challenge? And so I decided to write about the Democratic Party, and that's where Listen Liberal comes in. So how did the Democrats, you know, how did they change? Because they changed as much as the Republicans have. You know, the Republican Party has moved to the right, but the Democrats have moved to the right as well, beginning in the 1970s, and have become a very different party than what they were when I was growing up, you know, than when I was a child. They were a completely different orientation. Not completely different, but they slowly evolved. And so Listen Liberal is a study of the Democratic Party and how they became who they are today, how they have basically failed to meet the challenge of the right. And the short answer is that they have also become a party of the rich, just a different sort of slice of the rich, that both of the parties in our two-party system answer to different different kinds of rich people. You know, the Republicans, we all know about the Koch brothers. You know, we all know about oil billionaires and, you know, sort of very successful small business people who support the Republican Party. We're all very familiar with that. But there's different rich people who support the Democratic Party. And it has been slowly changing in recent years. As the Democratic Party becomes more and more friendly to the wealthy, that you now see Democrats routinely out fundraising Republicans, you know, which was unthinkable when I was a child. And today it happens all the time. It's happening right now.
Mm-hmm. You know, let me just ask a question there about that, because it's very interesting what you're saying. I mean, I think the fact that both sides have become kind of subsumed by money and influence, should be fairly self-evident to anyone who's paying attention. But what you bring out there is really a bit unique, which is that there are wealthy people who are not, you know, racist white supremacists, perhaps, or, you know, gas and oil billionaires, perhaps. But there are other wealthy people who also have different kinds of stakes. How would you characterize the Democratic Party donors?
These tend to be tasteful billionaires. So there's, by the way, I'm not the first one to write about this. There's a whole literature on wealthy Democrats. I mean, a lot of your listeners probably don't know about this literature. It's pretty I don't want to say it's obscure, but it's not something that has ever been very popular. And they all – everybody that writes about this tries to come up with ways of distinguishing between, you know, basically cool billionaires and bogus billionaires, you know, or how would you want to put it, polite billionaires and awful billionaires. And they all come up with different ways of doing it, but what – you know, that are more or less fanciful. And but there is an obvious way to do it, and that is to, you know, what kind of industry they're in, what kind of work they do, you know, that. And what I eventually determined was that the wealthy people who are going over to the who have become Democrats and who the Democratic Party appeals to, and by the way, the Democratic Party appeals to these people very openly, is what you might call the professional class. And this is the group that makes up the upper 10% of the income distribution in this country. You know, these are people with advanced degrees, tend to be white-collar people who have done very well in the last 20 or 30 years. You know, we think of Occupy Wall Street and their slogan, "We are the 99%. And that was a really good slogan, but that doesn't really capture the sort of sociological reality. It's more like the top 10% that have done very well with rising inequality, and it's more like the bottom 90% that have done badly. But that upper 10%, a lot of those people are Democrats. You look at the very wealthy suburban counties around the country, and by and large, they are either Democratic or they're slowly becoming Democratic. Did you see Orange County in California went for Hillary Clinton in 2016, which was, I think, not a first, but they haven't gone for a Democrat in a very long time, well, like ever, since it became what it is today, the suburbs of Los Angeles, or the place where I grew up, Johnson County, Kansas, suburb of Kansas City, which is, you know, very affluent suburb, professional class suburb of Kansas City, and was always very Republican when I was a child, and is today, also went for Hillary Clinton in 2016, very surprisingly so. And this is happening all over the country. But you can also look at it by industry, Allison. So have you ever heard the term the creative class?
Yes, of course.
These best-selling books. Well, that term is a lot of Democratic politicians really embrace that term and that idea and think of those people as their voters. And so, you know, what is meant by the creative class is basically everybody that works in a so-called creative industry, which is everything from law to advertising to, Silicon Valley people will include Wall Street in that. And, you know, because they dream up these, you know, new financial instruments and that sort of thing. Basically everything that requires an advanced degree, and those people are more and more becoming Democrats, or have been becoming Democrats since the 1970s. I talk too much, Allison.
So,
you know, I'm really sorry. I just blab and blab.
No. That's what you're here for. If they're also creative, then, and they're leaders and they have this affluence and they're supporting the Democratic Party, then why are we losing?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, right? Because, like, they're supposed to be so smart.
Yeah.
and I mean, you can put a point on this. I mean, look at Barack Obama's cabinet, you know, or it's mm-hmm. Bill Clinton's cabinet. These are, you know, some of the best educated people ever to sit in the Oval Office, you know. Barack uh-huh. Obama's team was – the Washington Post used to periodically run these stories about marveling at their educational credentials, you know, like they were all Harvard grads or they all had PhD. I don't remember what it was now, but there was an overwhelming number of Harvard grads and graduates of Oxford University in England. And he had people with all these different prizes, MacArthur Genius Prizes and Nobel Prizes and, you know, et cetera, in his cabinet, in his inner circle. You'd think all these smart people, how can they lose? You know, it's a great question. But part of it is that while the Democrats have reached out to the professional class, people that used to be Republicans back in the 50s and the 60s, while those people have moved over to the Democratic Party, there's this much larger group out there that the Democrats gave up on when they did this. And that group is the white working class. Or even the working class more generally, depending on how you look at it. And the Democrats basically convinced themselves that they didn't have to worry about those people. Do you remember back in the Clinton era, the Democrats had a saying, which is they would talk about different constituency groups of the Democratic Party and why they didn't need to do anything to help them. And the saying was, they have nowhere else to go. Do you remember this?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do.
Yeah,
I definitely do. And that's, well, I remember that was a big deja vu in the 2016 election. They have nowhere else
yeah,
to go.
Well, I was going around the country repeating this all the time because it makes people so mad, you know. And that was their attitude towards white working class, you know, union members. That was their attitude mm-hmm. towards black voters. That was their attitude towards all sorts of different groups. That the group that they needed to win, that they would work really hard to win, was this professional class, affluent white collar people in the suburbs. You know, we hear about them all the time. And then these sort of legacy Democratic constituency groups, they didn't need to worry about them. They have nowhere else to go because the Republicans are so outrageous and so radical and so right-wing that they'll never appeal to these people. Well, you know, that's just not so. The Republicans have dreamed up all sorts of different ways of appealing to these people, specifically the white working class, as we all know. They've been appealing to them for decades now, since Richard Nixon, with all of these culture war things. And, I mean, it goes on to this day. You know, it just the culture wars won't stop. I'm sick of opening the newspaper and hearing about what the latest thing is. You know, there's always something new and awful that they have dreamed up. And, you know, at the end of the day, Allison, I love that question about, like, if they're so damn smart, why don't they win? Because the other side is smart too. And and politically speaking, the Republicans have always been, you know, they come out of the business community, and so they might like not have a lot of fancy college degrees, and they might even be, you know, like Trump, you know, tell a lot of lies, seem very stupid, but they're very good at the game. You know, they're very good at the chess game of politics, at the sort of at the strategy and the tactics, and the, you know, the ugliness of it. They're excellent at it, as a matter of fact. And so when, you know, one of the problems with the professional class is that they really believe in consensus and courtesy and norms and, you know, doing everything within these narrow parameters of the acceptable, you know, the professional consensus. And I'm sorry, but that's just a recipe for disaster in politics when you're up against somebody that doesn't recognize any rules at all.
You know? Right. I mean, you know, people have been critical of the Democratic Party, and sometimes, you know, younger people will, you know, be communicating on social media. I'm in conversation with them, and, you know, they're railing against Hillary Clinton. And, you know, I've often said, well, you know, you don't have to talk to me about the Democratic Party because Charles Schumer is my senator. And, you know, when he was named the Senate Minority Leader, I was really in despair. I was, this is going to be terrible. And it seems like, you know, it's like kind of almost like every tenth time that there is some opportunity to take a position, to organize the Democrats, to score points and characterize what's happening, it's like one time out of ten he'll say something, and the other nine times it's like he's shrugging and it's all just walking by as one Republican initiative after another. And granted, they have a majority right now, which, you know, if we haven't had our democracy completely taken over, which is, I hope, the case, it's certainly, we've had all kinds of election tampering, you know, going back many years, so I'm not 100% confident about that. But, you know, granted, the Republicans have a majority right now, but, you know, even in a minority, when they had a minority, they were doing a lot more with it. I mean, is it that Wall Street wants him to be polite, that he can't go against their interests? I mean, is it gentility, or is it some kind of influence that is tying their hands?
Well, a huge part of it is that they don't sense the crisis. They don't sense there's a crisis in any personal way. So for them, you know, for a lot of these, the leading Democrats, you know, even look, we just came out of a really bad recession, financial crisis and recession. I mean, that should have been our generation's, you know, 1932, our, you know, moment for Franklin Roosevelt, you know, for a New Deal. And it didn't happen. And a lot of the reasons that it didn't happen is that Democrats are pretty much aloof from the kind of people who are on the receiving edge of that of the financial hard times. It's not that Republicans are any different, but Republicans are really good at faking it. You know, because they can see, it's like, you remember the Tea Party movement? It was the most incredible trumped up fake populist movement I've ever seen. It was unbelievable. Yeah. They were right out there with it as soon as Barack Obama came into the Oval Office. They were ready to go with their fake protest movement, and Democrats couldn't even get, you know, Democrats who are the ones who have inherited, you know, who are technically the party that should be speaking to that kind of sentiment, they couldn't figure that out, you know. They couldn't figure out how to appeal to that sentiment, and a lot of that is because they don't feel it personally. They're very much divorced from that part of America. They're very, very wary of embracing their kind of populist labor heritage. I live in D.C. I'm around Democrats all the time. They can't stand that stuff. Do you remember how Rahm Emanuel would? He always badmouths those people. They can't stand that part of the Democratic left. They hate them. You know, but that just sort of begs the question. That just takes us back to where we started. Why are they like that? Part of it is their affluence. Part of it is that they really believe in bipartisanship. By the way, this is part of the revolution, you know, not revolution, part of the big change in the Democratic Party that I describe in Listen Liberal is when they, you know, they became the party that believes in bipartisanship. And that really, for them, that is a central belief that everybody in the professional class, and they look at Republicans and they say, well, those people aren't, you know, those people in Congress are not that much different from us. They live, you know, just down the street from me in the suburbs, et cetera, et cetera. They're very similar to us. And I know, you know, we're all reasonable people. And I know that in private, we all agree on all the issues. You know, we all agree that deficit spending is bad, et cetera, et cetera. Why can't we all just get along? And for Democrats, this is an article of faith. Because that's really who they are. They are these, you know, professional types who believe in professional consensus. And, you know, consensus is in the sort of sociology of the professions, that's how a profession works, is through consensus. Mm-hmm. Everybody agrees. And everybody agreeing is really important to the Democrats. The Republicans don't give a damn about that. You know, they want to push and push and push and drag the spectrum further to the right. And the Democrats are, play right into their hands again and again and again. By the way, I should take a step back here. So with Listen Liberal, one of the ways that I wrote it was by doing a lot of reading in the sociology of the professions, which sounds really boring and, in fact, is really boring. But there's this whole literature, is academic literature out there of sociologists studying the professional class. And as I was reading this literature, it dawned on me, it's like, oh my goodness, they're talking about the Democrats here, you know, and you put two and two together, you know, this literature with the sort of history of the Democratic Party, and all of a sudden, it makes sense. And you understand why the Democrats are who they are and why they're so weak and why they fail. And it's it comes out of their greatest triumph, you know, their embrace of professionalism back in the 1970s. And their success with this group has also been their downfall.
That's really interesting because one of the things that that the progressive left brings in is a sense of outrage at inequities, at racism, at the targeting and victimization of certain sectors of people, of, you know, concern and outrage about the environment. And it's almost as if that range of emotions, you know, the anger, the outrage, the sorrow, championing of victims is somehow alien. It's like to a certain kind of moderate Democrat, it's kind of like we have to be kind, we have to be nice, we shouldn't identify with being a victim or we'll become one. You know, there's sort of this kind of attitudinal consensus that if we stay within those bounds and we, you know, treat everyone with love, then the world will come right again, you know. And as the world instead has unraveled, you know, and you know, what we're seeing now is a great unraveling, which, you know, hopefully we'll be able to take that opportunity to kind of recollect and reorient. But, you know, what we've had so far is a tremendous unraveling. And, you know, it seems like within the parameters of that kind of politeness, we don't readily find the energy, the tools, or the permission to go further somehow.
There's a huge mistrust of that emotion, and well, of emotions generally. The sort of ideal of the professional class is there's two of them, but one is the ideology of the professional class is what we call technocracy, which is not really much of an ideology at all, but it's their sort of utopian vision, which is that, you know, you put experts in charge, you know, rational, calm, collected, do everything by the book. You know, the creative class, put them in charge, and That will solve all your problems. There are no grand ideological disputes anymore. And Democrats have been saying this since for a long time. I think it was if you go back and look, there was a literature in the 60s, you know, the sort of consensus. They called it the consensus literature, sort of consensus you know, academia, and like consensus history, consensus sociology, et cetera. And that was their greatest faith, was that all the ideological disputes are of the past, and the all that is required in the future is expertise. And this has always gone hand in hand with professional class politics. Back then, it was in both parties. Today, it's almost entirely in the Democratic Party. And it has led to all sorts of disasters. I'll give you two examples. One is the Vietnam War. Do you remember there's a great book called The Best and the Brightest, A History of the Vietnam War. And it's basically about everything we're talking about now, how they put all of these brilliant people in charge of the military and the foreign policy. And they dreamed up the Vietnam War and refused to get out of it. And, you know, we're running everything through their computers, and it was doing it all with, you know, their expert studies and all this sort of thing. And it was just this incredible disaster. It's a wonderful story. And it's basically not wonderful. I mean, it's an amazing piece of journalism, but it's a horrible story. Of course, it's the Vietnam War. But you wonder, how did that go on and on and on when it was such a catastrophe? And a big part of the reason is because the professionals that were in charge refused to listen to criticism from outside their profession, refused to listen to any kind of dissent. And that is very typical of professionals and professionalism. The what I would put right alongside that, and what I spend a lot of time in Listen Liberal talking about, is the failure of this is a smaller failure, I think, but the failure of the Obama administration to take advantage of the financial crisis and the bank bailouts, you know, the failure to prosecute anybody, the failure to reorganize the banking system, when Barack Obama had the perfect opportunity, you know, the failure to really do much of anything, you know, basically continued the Bush bailout policies, didn't do anything different, didn't go after anybody, didn't even fire anybody, didn't take any of the banks apart. And all of these things could have been done, by the way. It didn't require Congress. You know, it was all – the power was all in the hands of the executive branch. And why not? A big part of it was because the people who were running the administration, and I mentioned earlier, they were all these sort of prize-winning professionals. Obama had the president of Harvard, for Pete's sake, you know, Larry Summers, and so many other top-ranking economists and lawyers and, you know, people. Why didn't they take why didn't they do what was necessary? Why didn't they get tough with Wall Street when they had the chance? A lot of it is because they identified with those people. They identified with the guys on Wall Street. They didn't want to listen to people like, say, you and me, who are complaining about, from the outside about these policies. They are professionals. They respect their peers. They regard their peers very highly, and they don't take seriously voices from outside their disciplines. And so it's very easy for them to look at the guys on Wall Street and say, well, they made one mistake, or they made a little mistake or something like that, even though they sunk the whole world into a terrible recession. Some countries still haven't recovered. This is a colossal disaster, the financial crisis. I mean, in some ways, this is what sets the table for Donald Trump, you know, what sets the stage, what makes Donald Trump possible. And they really failed to take the steps that were called for in the aftermath of that. And that failure I lay completely, 100%, at the feet of these, brilliant, creative, professional class geniuses in the Obama administration. Again, I talk too much, Allison, and I'm so sorry. I know you just want yes or no answers.
Not at all. Oh, come on, you're kidding.
know, when they showed the Vietnam series recently, it was kind of like, you know, we did all of this, we killed all these people, we, got engaged in this country, you know, on the wrong
yeah.
side for unclear reasons, but we were well intentioned. So it's kind of
yeah.
like, you know, our intentions, I think they dug and they scraped, and actually there was a lot of covert racism that was embedded in that people
oh,
didn't
yeah.
cop to,
absolutely.
Didn't look at, you know. But the pretense is that we're well-intentioned, we're nice, we're kind, we are not racist because we kind of have a more, a covert form of racism, in fact. So, you know, just to make sure that we kind of jump ahead to your current book, Rendezvous with Oblivion, where is this taking us? Where are we now, in your estimation?
We're on that sinking Titanic.
Yeah.
We're on the Titanic as it slips beneath the waves. Now, it's
mm-hmm.
so Rendezvous with Oblivion is a collection of essays going back to 2011. I used to be a columnist for Harper's Magazine, and before that for the Wall Street Journal. And it's a collection of that stuff. Actually, I don't think I have any of my Wall Street Journal essays in there, but I have a lot of the ones from Harper's and a lot of the ones from Salon.com. And it's a lot of my cultural reporting, a lot of my my writing about academia, and then a lot of my political stuff, sort of day-to-day political stuff that I've written over the years. And it's all about the subject that I mentioned when we started the show, inequality, the sort of great U-turn that this country took beginning in the 70s and 80s. One of my favorite essays, for example, is about the rise of the McMansion. I wanted to do a study, a history of the McMansion.
Mm-hmm.
Where did this architectural form come from? And how has it changed over the years? And can we relate its changes to, say, changes in the tax code? Or, you know, what made it possible? What made it what it is today? And it was easy to start to find the beginning of that architectural form. But in the end, I couldn't really – and the architectural form has changed, but it always changes just in one direction. It gets bigger, bigger and bigger and bigger, and they add more and more rooms. And it just turned out to be pointless because it's it was a fun essay. It's one of my favorite essays. But
mm-hmm.
Gigantic houses and people and inequality growing and growing and growing, and everybody keeps predicting that, okay, now it's gone so far, it can't go any farther, it has to reverse course, and it never does. And I think I have three different occasions when people predicted this over the years, like at the end of the 80s, when the financial crisis happened, people keep predicting that that the trend towards gigantic houses has to change, and it never does. They just get bigger as inequality gets worse and worse and worse.
Isn't all of this also kind of seated in the notion of competitive economic success under capitalism, and the notion that each individual, can sort of – and this is something that I think both – parties, both Republican and Democrats, affluent Democrats share, if I succeed, there's always the opportunity for success. My personal success in which I'm, kind of striving is kind of paramount. And, there isn't really much of a capacity to see how my success is connected to the depletion of the of others' lives or of the earth itself. So we have this. We're kind of on this depleting cycle, but we think we're on an infinite progress cycle in which everyone can find their place if they work hard
Operation
enough. And aren't,
infinite progress.
What?
Yeah,
infinite progress. Yes.
Yeah, I was just making a joke. Operation Infinite Progress.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's That's a good point. And the term that I would use, the term that I do use to describe it, is meritocracy. At least that's how I would describe the attitude of, you know, the members of the professional class, the creative class that we've been talking about, this idea that everybody gets what they deserve, and what they deserve is defined by how they did in school. And you come across this attitude in all sorts of different places. There's this smugness about it. In the, you know, the, and there's this kind of not just smugness, but it's like astrology. It's a what do you call it? It's a superstition about higher education, like as though, you know, it was a perfect hierarchy, you know, and they define, you know, the school that you went to defines who you are. You put that sticker on the back of your car, your truck, or whatever, and that's who you are the rest of your life. You know, where you went to college, and the rewards will come to you in life accordingly. And the Republicans have their own version of it, the sort of Ayn Rand idea, you know, that the strong and the tough, those are the ones who will rise to the top. Those are the ones who will succeed, and they succeed because they deserve to. But both sides have this vision of people succeeding because they deserve to succeed. And I'm here to tell you, Allison, it just ain't so. It's just not true.
Right.
It's a gigantic, you know, it's imaginary. It is the great sort of fatuous superstition that our society runs on. Plenty of deserving people fail in life, and plenty of people they aren't successful. They're affluent because they were, you know, born into families that are affluent before them. And that's, I mean, once you say that, it's so obvious to everyone, you know. But that sort of is what underpins all of the essays in the volume, is that my skepticism towards any claims about meritocracy.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's exactly also, I mean, you know, it's almost like the recent Kavanaugh display, I don't know how else to describe it, you know, was actually making that so evident. It was like, how can, you know, his prior alleged behavior, as, you know, expressed by, you know, three different women, intervene in his predestined trajectory toward the highest judicial post in the land, for which, in fact,
not only that,
he was
but did you notice
well
did you notice when they would talk about the guys that he went to high school with? You know, he went to this all boys private high school here, right near where I live, and they're all successes of some kind or another, with a few exceptions. You know, there are a few exceptions, but. There's these aspects of American life that we, as a people, we don't get, and we know they're there. You know, we know that if you can pay for your kid to go to a high school like that, he's going to succeed in life. You know, he may not be Brett Kavanaugh, he may not get on the Supreme Court, but, you know, CEO of something or you know, something like that. And it's not because he's more talented. I mean, I don't know anything about Brett Kavanaugh. I'll tell you the truth. I didn't even pay attention to the hearings until Blasey Ford came forward with her, you know, her accusation. I didn't even pay attention. I don't know if the guy is, you know, I don't know what his views are. I was in Australia when most of it happened. I missed the whole thing. But, you know, we all know that that's the case with that kind of institution, but we pretend that it's a meritocracy. You know, it's comforting to us to believe that the talented are who succeeds.
And then, you know, people who are falling below that 10%, you know, can lift up their eyes and get there one day, but as it's kind of like a yawning divide, you know, has opened up between that 10% and the 90%.
Can I give you an example from my own personal life?
Sure. Please.
So one of the things that shocked me when Trump first chose Kavanaugh is that he is exactly the same age as me. I think he was born within a month of me.
Wow.
And, you know, but I'm from, you know, I'm from Kansas City and he's from here and whatever. And so, you know, it's finally happened. I'm now old enough that there's a Supreme Court judge who's my exact age. You know, and that's a sign of getting old, but it makes you reflect. It makes you think back about it. And I was in high school debate with a lot of the guys, high school debate in Kansas, with a lot of guys who are, now in politics in Kansas. For example, Chris Kobach, you know, I didn't know him very well, but he was on the debate team for one of the Topeka schools, and I was on the team for one of the Kansas City schools. So I knew who he was. I debated him once, and I used to, you know, I'd look at, and so he and I have gone our separate ways in life. Obviously, you know, he is Secretary of State of Kansas. He's running for governor right now. I think he has a good chance. He'll probably be the next governor of Kansas, and after that, he'll probably run for president. I would not be surprised to see him run for president. He's very talented. He's very smart. Trump really likes him. You know, he's the next. In some ways, he is waiting in the wings to be the next Trump. That's my take on, you know, his political future. But it's funny, when I was a journalist, I would look at guys like him and other people that I knew in high school who have gone into politics and say, you guys are you're opportunists. You know, you have signed up with this Republican Party that is moving to the right, and it's, you know, it's all a fake. You don't really believe in what you're selling. And I'm doing what I believe in, and it's so great to be a journalist. And you know what, Allison? Chris Kobach is probably going to be the next governor of Kansas, and journalism in this country is basically dead. And
really?
I look at those guys now that I used to scorn for their opportunism, not him, but so many, you know, a lot of people that I knew in high school who signed up with their right-wing revolution, not because they believed in it, but because it was a career. It was a career choice. And I used to be so not contemptuous is not the word. It wasn't contempt. I felt a kind of pity for those guys, and now I look at them and I'm like, I think they made the right move. You know, I used to be a conservative. I used to really believe in all the conservative stuff, and I turned away from it in the 1980s. And I sometimes think, you know, if I had not followed through and, you know, not paid attention to my conscience and, you know, I believed in doing what, you know, in following your beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And that would lead ultimately to, to happiness or to fulfillment or something like that. But I look back now and I'm like, geez, why didn't I stick with being a Republican? You know what I mean?
Why didn't I, you know, divide my soul?
Why didn't I, if I don't believe in it, even if I don't believe in it at all, as a career move, you see what I'm getting at here? I'm getting very cynical now in my old age. It's Brett Kavanaugh did it to me.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, let's talk for a minute about what's going on with journalism, because, you know, the fact that you, a premier journalist, and you're not the only one either, you know, are kind of like, what does the demise of journalism mean for our country and for everybody's safety, security, and indeed future in a time of climate change and the subversion of democracy? What does it mean if we have a go-along to get-along journalism, or if the authentic
even if the journalism is more liberal than it used to be, and it is, by the way. The New York Times and the Washington Post have definitely shifted in the last couple of years and identified themselves with the Democratic Party in a way that they never did before. I don't just mean on their op-ed pages. I mean the whole thing. And that's kind of striking, but it's not it's not necessarily going to be healthy or good for the Democrats or for liberalism. Why? Because journalism is, I mean, the wheels have come off the bus here. You know, you go anywhere else in America, Washington, D.C. is a very well scrutinized place. There's journalists everywhere in Washington, D.C. It's one of the most, you know, journalistically scrutinized locales in the world. I used to live on a block in the district in D.C., and you know, I was a columnist for the Wall Street Journal at the time. The guy across the street from me was also worked for the Journal. The woman catty corner from me worked for the Washington Post. There's someone from the New York Times right down the street. It was, you know, there's journalists everywhere in this town. You go to Kansas City, and the newspaper, the local newspaper, is you know, down to 16 pages or something, and it's mainly wire service feed. There's very few local, you know, local reporters anymore. The columnists, being a columnist there is a day job. You know, you do something else to actually make a living. This is common. If your newspaper hasn't gone completely out of business, it is a shadow of its former self. Even strong paper. I mean, the Kansas City Star was once one of the country's great newspapers. But you look at the Chicago Tribune, which was until very recently one of the most important papers in America, or the Los Angeles Times, and even these are really suffering. You know, they have been hacked down to next to nothing. You know, it is shocking to look at them. They're selling their real estate. You know, they sold Tribune Tower in Chicago. It's very disturbing what is happening. And in this environment, you have basically three newspapers in this country that are surviving: the Times, the Post, and the Wall Street Journal. And these three papers, mainly just the Times and the Post, though, these two papers set the agenda for the journalism of an entire country, of a country of 300 million people. That's not healthy, Allison. That's really, really bad. And they have their views are, and there's still, you know, tons of excellent journalism in both of them. In some ways, they're doing as well as they have ever done. But they're very predictable. Their views are extremely predictable. Their op-ed pages mirror each other. You know, it's they have come to be very, very, very close. They'll often have the same photograph on page one. It's not a healthy environment, you know, the country is ill served when it only has two newspapers. They're both on the East Coast. They're both focused on the same. They cover the exact same things. It is not healthy. And they also, because they, this is going to sound weird, but their demographic, and I would include NPR in what I'm about to say, their demographic audience overlaps almost completely with the Democratic sort of vision of the professional class. You know, that's who writes for them. That's who they see as their audience. And as a result, they are closer and closer and closer with the sort of Democratic Party vision as the years go by. And what gets left out of this is, you know, all these sort of things that newspapers used to do. For example, something I used to be very concerned with is labor reporting. I used to write about strikes, Allison, in a previous life. That is gone from these papers. I mean, they will cover a strike if it goes on for a really long time. But there's no there also used to be blue-collar voices on op-ed pages. And that sounds crazy now, right? Because every op-ed page, we expect them to be graduates of prestigious universities, if not professors, you know. But once upon a time, there were lots of newspaper columnists that wrote for blue-collar audiences. I think of Mike Royko in Chicago back in the old days, you know. But there were lots of people like that. And that's completely gone. I talk too much.
No, so it's that people basically, only a certain group of people regard themselves as represented. Other people are kind of left out of the
conversation. By journalists, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. I
read the newspaper and I really enjoy it.
We don't know where we went wrong. What was that?
I say I am part of the professional class, and I am a political junkie, and I read the newspaper and I'm like, yeah, this is great. You know, they're doing great reporting at the New York Times these days. But it doesn't take too long to figure out that there are millions and millions and millions of people in this country that are not well served by by their focus and their their sort of professional class obsessions.
And so those people don't feel represented. They don't see candidates that seem to be speaking to their issues as reported in the press, and then they don't show up to vote, which leaves the people, you know, in the liberal class sending postcards begging them to.
Or I would actually say it's put an uglier spin on it. Those people feel like the way they're treated by the media is that they are scolded, that they are constantly being scolded. And they are, Alice, and that is a correct interpretation on their part. You know, they turn on the TV and it's constantly telling them to stop being such bad people and that they need to reform themselves. And Trump, in some dark, ugly way, Trump gets this, and Trump speaks to the sort of frustration and resentment of that of those people. And by the way, scolding, this is, I'm working right now on a whole theory of scolding. Politics is a form of scolding, you know. And there's a term that I use at the very end of Rendezvous with Oblivion where I say that what liberals, why are liberals not upset by, I mean, they are upset by the Republican dominance, but why aren't they taking the steps necessary to reverse it permanently? You know, I mean, we can all see where the Democrats went wrong. It's obvious. We can all see what they would have to do to become a permanent majority party again. It's obvious, at least to me. Why aren't they doing those things? Because they've got something that they're perfectly happy with now. I call it a utopia of scolding.
What would they be doing that they're not doing?
Oh, they'd be a party that talks forthrightly about working class issues. I mean, I don't know if you're aware of this, Alison, but the working class people outnumber professional class people by an enormous margin. It's like they're 80% of the population, you know. And you base your appeal on that, and you're going to do all right. You know, it would take. It's not just a matter of talking about their issues here and there, and including them in your list of 25 points or something like that. But like actually talking to them in a way that they feel is authentic, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's all sorts of things that you'd have to do. But once you decided that that's the kind of party you wanted to be, you'd be able to do that. And that's who the Democrats used to be. I mean, that's who they were. Once you do those things, you're going to win. They're not interested in that. And one of the reasons is that they're very satisfied. They aren't really troubled by what the Republicans are doing because they love being a party of scolds. And there's something very satisfying to them, I think, about scolding people, And that is its own – in a certain sense, that is its own reward. This is me in my darkest and most cynical, by the way. But this my next project is –
Bernie Sanders talks to working class people.
Oh, absolutely. No, here's a guy that's getting it right.
He's regarded as too rough-hewn. Oh, no, we can't go there.
He's a crank here in Washington, D.C. They call him a crank.
Right.
And he's the most popular politician in America. We're at this weird point right now, Alison, where the smart people in the media the sort of pundit class, they don't get it. But there's a lot of politicians who do get it because they look at a guy like Bernie Sanders and they're like, oh, it's obvious that he's on to something. And they also can see what his – I've talked to a lot of Democratic politicians, and they have watched their voting base get whittled away, you know, by people like Trump, by this whole – all this Republican populism, you know, this fake populism, this right-wing stuff. And they have watched that whittle their voter base away, and they can see it happening. And so for them, there's no doubt. The doubt is only in the minds of the sort of pundit class, the journalism class, you know, those people, the professionals. But plenty of politicians
entrenched
get it.
Democrats who kind of have a good thing. I mean, you know, and they don't want anything coming around and derailing.
Exactly. Now this is a good. You're onto it there. They're prosperous. Democrats fundraise like crazy nowadays. It is a comfortable thing. It's almost like being a country club Republican in the 1950s is what they are now. And it's a nice thing to be, even if you are a permanent minority, you know, which is crazy. And I almost can't stand uttering those words. But I think that they're comfortable with it and that they don't have a real fire in the belly to do something about it. Some of them do here and there, but as a group, no, they're not particularly concerned about it. They like being who they are.
I mean, the whole country is going off the rails, and you know we're losing democracy. We're heading toward climate change, but I'm comfortable right now. Yeah, is basically.
Yep.
You know, I'm
it.
Good.
You nailed it, Allison.
I'm good
that
with
is
it.
Exactly right.
Today, I'm comfortable. Be in the moment.
Yes.
Thank you so much for speaking with me today on Connect the Dots, Thomas Frank. I mean, you certainly have plenty of fire and brilliant insight, and it's been really a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much for taking the time. Listeners, make sure you go out and get Rendezvous with Oblivion. Thomas is both a brilliant and witty and accurate speaker, and he's also a great writer. You'll really, as much as you can enjoy reading about our demise, you're going to love this book. No, I'm just kidding. But it's like,
it actually is
a
fun book.
Really,
it will make you laugh.
It's like you can't cure the problem if you don't have a diagnosis. And Rendezvous with Oblivion is the diagnosis. And so, and I hope that it awakens a lot of people and everyone go out and get it, because we also want Thomas Frank to keep reporting and democracy to regain its footing. Thank you so much for being with us today. It's been really a pleasure having you.
But the pleasure was all mine, Allison.
Where?